You know how I say every now and then that this is a global economy and we only live in it? You know who says the same thing? Jack Lew, that's who. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 11th day of April today. Should you be curious about the place of America in the global economy, might I refer you to the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, featuring an article from the pen of the current occupant of 1500 Pennsylvania Avenue, entitled America and the Global Economy, A Case for U.S. Leadership. The author is one Jacob Lew. He goes by Jack, or to me, Mr. Secretary of the Treasury, that is. Sir, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
You have written here a manifesto, basically, for America as the indispensable economic nation. But we're doing it in a changing world, you point out. And it seems to me that what you're talking about here is us giving up some economic influence so we can get some economic influence.
Actually, I don't think it's about giving up anything. I think that what we've done over the last 70 years is we've worked to build institutions that promote both American values and American interests. And we have to make sure that we maintain that ability going forward. So what I'm saying is we have to make sure that we don't see countries pulling away from a system that very much promotes American interests. We need to make sure they stay in it and that all the changes are changes that we think are in our U.S. interest.
This is the system of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the system that came out of World War II. How do you convince countries to stay in it when, as you point out in the first paragraph of this piece, it took the Congress of the United States 5 years to agree on reforms to the International Monetary Fund?
You know, the interesting thing, Kai, is that I think the world wants us to play this role. I think that
That's a gutsy statement.
Over these last 5 years, I had to explain over and over and over again why it was taking so long. The desire was for the U.S. to ratify the IMF reforms and for the IMF to remain the centrally important institution that it is. I actually think that if you look at the structure of the IMF quota reforms, it tells a really interesting story.
Quota reforms are how much voting power.
That's how much voting,
has.
What your share in the IMF is.
Right.
And you know, 5 years ago, there was an agreement where essentially the U.S. went down a tiny, tiny bit, by a small fraction. And other countries in the world were really juggling around their shares, their position, to reflect the shift mostly from Europe to emerging economies. So here you had winners and losers in the United States that was, compared to the others, staying the same, yet we were having a hard time passing it through Congress. It was profoundly in the U.S. interest to have this take place, for the emerging countries to feel invested in the system where the other developed countries were prepared to go along with it. That's exactly the point of my piece. That's why we have to be engaged, and we have to make sure that we do the things that are smart to keep everyone else engaged.
You are making the case for American engagement internationally at a time when domestically income inequality is up, wages have been stuck for decades, and I wonder how you think that's going to play back here at a time when in this political season, free trade and internationalism are taking a beating on both sides of this election campaign.
The last few decades have seen an awful lot of pressures coming to bear on middle-class families in America, middle-class workers in America. And it's not just trade. It's more broadly globalization.
Right.
It's the modern technologies that are changing the shape of what the workplace looks like and what people do at work. And frankly, it's been economic policies and economic crisis that have taken a toll on a lot of middle-class families. I mean, if you came out of the Great Recession having lost your life savings, where it was in the equity in your home, if you graduated from high school and college during the recession and couldn't find a job right away, or if you were 50 years old and you lost your job, those are deep scars. I'm not surprised. Now, we have policy solutions that really do work there, but it's not cutting America off from the world. The growth in the global economy is growth that ought to provide future jobs for American workers, both in services and in manufacturing. That's what we need to make sure is the opportunity that's open.
It ought to provide it. But if this issue of foreign affairs lands on some kitchen table in Ottumwa, Iowa, with some auto worker or some farmer or some machinist who's been out of a job for years and can't find work, how do you make the case that this is what's good for the American economy?
I think that if you look at the economic growth in the last 50 years, you know, we have seen around the world lifting people out of poverty, creating conditions for a more peaceful world, for a world where the United States could have enormous markets to sell into, both goods and services. And the fact that it has been very hard for that auto worker is something that we have to ask, what do we need to do as a matter of domestic policy? First of all, there has to be fair trade. It cannot be that the U.S. auto is competing against an auto that is unfairly subsidized by practices which in a good trade agreement aren't allowed. Secondly, we have to make sure that we have the kinds of policies here at home where we provide people with the skills they need to get the jobs that are available in the economy, and where we build the infrastructure in our own society so that we can have a growing economy in the future. I think the idea of cutting us off from the world would ultimately shrink, not grow, the job opportunities.
All right, so that's the first chunk. Coming up in the second half of the program, what the Secretary of the Treasury had to say about too big to fail, about tax inversions, and the fate of American companies in that global economy he was writing about. Also, by the way, his latest thoughts on the fate of the $10 bill. On Wall Street today, awash. Basically, all three major indices finished within spitting distance of where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a study out today in the Journal of the American Medical Association that's worth spending some time on. It's about wealth. Well, it's about poverty, really, and life expectancy. We already knew that wealthier people tend to live longer than poorer people do. What's interesting about this new research, though, is that poorer people seem to live longer or shorter depending on where they live. That means there's a lot of attention about to be paid to ways to improve local health and wellness programs, smoking bans and trans fat bans, those kinds of things. But what do you suppose the new data means for national programs? Think Social Security, for instance. Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
If you're rich, you're likely to do fine wherever you are. The nation's wealthiest tend to live 10 to 15 years longer than those with the lowest life expectancy. If you're not rich, you might want to consider where you live. Raj Chetty teaches econ at Stanford and co-authored the paper.
In Birmingham, Alabama, the poor are gaining as much in life expectancy as the rich overall, about 3 years over the last 15 years. Whereas in other places like Tampa, Florida, the poor are actually losing.
And losing or winning appears to tie in with choices people make about how to live. Places with effective anti-smoking or obesity campaigns could add years onto their poor citizens' lives. Chetty says lessons from cities with longer-lived citizens could translate over to ones not doing so well.
I think focusing in particular on the health of disadvantaged Americans, and even at the national level, trying to set benchmarks or target programs at schools or communities in certain areas could be very valuable.
But how much can this new data inform national programs? Well, it depends on the program.
I'm really not so sure that the fact that it's people live long in New York and not so long in Detroit has any immediate application for Social Security.
Alicia Minnell directs the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. She says Social Security benefits are tied to the same ages for everyone. You couldn't adjust the age that Detroit's residents get benefits earlier or push New York's later. The best bet for now might be to come up with national benchmarks for local health programs. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Facebook's annual developers conference gets going tomorrow in San Francisco, and informed speculation says the company has something in the works that's going to let businesses on Facebook use chatbots, those automated faux customer service assistants you have almost certainly seen in your web travels. They're becoming increasingly popular, chatbots are, and the companies that make the software those chatbots run on are pulling down some serious venture capital investments. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on that.
Think of all the ways that businesses try to answer your questions without actually having to talk to you. Frequently asked questions, pages, automated phone robots.
For account access, say your account or card number.
This is because humans are expensive, and not all companies can afford as many as they might need.
Please hold for the next available representative.
And so instead, they cultivate in their customers a sense of murderous, blinding rage that slowly eats away at their humanity. Chatbots are basically an artificial intelligence alternative.
It gives the human an illusion that they're actually communicating with an entity that understands.
Yolanda Gill is a research professor of computer science at the University of Southern California. Chatbots have actually been in development since the 60s, but all the different technologies behind them have been improving rapidly over the past several years.
Natural language processing, AI, messaging, but these five or six things all got to a point just in 2016 where they're kind of over the good enough threshold.
Phil Libin is managing director at General Catalyst, a venture capital firm. He says we are on the verge of a major transformation where we can move from apps or navigating websites to just asking a computer to do something, whether through text message or Facebook or voice. At the same time, cautions David Schumel of IDC.
I still think it's early days yet. These systems are not general purpose.
Bots can have conversations or solve specific problems. We're talking about things like booking flights. We're not quite at the level of R2-D2 and C-3PO just yet. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there's no doubt that the oil and gas downturn has positively affected our business.
You got your losers and you got your winners, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials started the week off 20 points lower, 0.1%, ended at 17,556. The NASDAQ eased 17 points on a downward slide, 0.3%, 48.33. The S&P 500 slipped 5 points, about 0.25%, 2,041. All right, so here we go. A lot of wheels today. Hertz Global Holdings says too many rental cars are on the road. It should know. It also owns Dollar, Thrifty, and Firefly. So Hertz lowered its forecast and shares reversed 11%. Avis Budget Group, that is Avis Budget, Zipcar, and Payless, down 8% today. Superior Industries International, it makes cast aluminum wheels for cars, up 0.75%. Supreme Industries, it makes truck bodies and trolleys, down about 0.5%. American Axle and Manufacturing of 0.4% today. Bond prices, while they fell, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus rose to 1.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There were two recent and real-life examples of America and American companies in the global economy that I asked Treasury Secretary Liu about in the second half of our interview. The first was the unsealing last week by a federal judge of her ruling that removed MetLife, the big insurance company, from the government's official list of companies that are too big to fail, a listing that for the companies on it imposes increased costs and regulatory obligations. The judge in the case said the government's decision-making in putting MetLife on the list was arbitrary and capricious, her words, fatally flawed, also her words, and she called on the government to fully explain its rationale. So my question to Secretary Liu was, why is it so hard for the government to decide and describe what is too big to fail and what is not?
Well, Kai, on that ruling, obviously we disagree with it and the government is appealing. But let me take a step back and just remind everyone what was at issue, what is at issue in this decision. You go back to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. Nobody expected the companies that failed to fail. They were not sitting on the edge of disaster, AIG and Lehman. It was a surprise. It came out of the blue for most who were watching. Part of Wall Street reform said that should never happen again. We need a process where you're not looking for how likely is it that a firm would fail. You're looking at if a firm fails, could it bring the whole economy to its knees? We went through that process in a very careful way and have designated not hundreds, but, you know, roughly less than a dozen firms very big, very interconnected firms. The decisions are hundreds of pages long with detailed analysis. I think it will withstand review, but I think the question we have to ask is, do we ever again want to face the possibility of a firm's failure putting at risk the whole economy? And that's why it's so important that we get this right.
The answer, obviously, is that we don't want that. The question, though, was, why is it so hard for the government to say this is what systemically important financial institutions mean?
You know, I think
because the judge said you didn't do it.
I think that, well, without getting into all the detail, there are certain aspects of the ruling that I think are just incorrect. And I think, you know, take, for example, the premise, should we have to show that it's likely a firm will fail? No. These are very unlikely events. That's one of the questions that the mm-hmm. judge asked. Did you show that it's likely that the firm would fail? It was not likely that AIG would fail or that Lehman would fail. These are very remote possibilities with highly destructive consequences if it happens. So you're not really looking for the probability. You're looking for what is the consequence. That's what the statute tells you to look for. The question of looking at a cost-benefit analysis, the statute didn't have that requirement in it. That's not the measure that is being looked for. The consequences of a failure are immense, almost infinite in terms of the damage that the financial crisis in 2007-08 caused. One would never be able to predict with any kind of precision the scope of that kind of broad systemic failure. There's a reason that it wasn't put in the statute. I actually think the work was done correctly. I think the work was done well. And we're going to appeal, and it'll be up to an appeals court to decide.
Tax inversions. Last week, you came out with, I believe it's your third action on tax inversions, companies buying other companies overseas to change their tax liabilities. It, I guess, worked the way you wanted it to because Pfizer and Allergan have called off their merger. Both of the CEOs of those companies, though, came out last week and said, we were playing by the rules that Congress made up, and now here's the Treasury Department coming in and changing them on us midstream. Isn't that sort of the antithesis of what your article is about, that we have to be able to adapt and play in a global economy?
Look, I think anyone who has listened to what I've said over the last two-plus years could not be surprised that we were looking to do anything we could do administratively to stop the pipeline of inversions. We took action twice administratively. It had some effect each time we did it. And each time we made clear that we were looking at taking additional action. And we even said that in the case of earnings stripping, we were looking at what could we do in that regard. I think that the right answer here is legislation. There's no doubt. I've been saying all along the only way to do it so that it sticks is legislation. I'm sure there are smart tax lawyers and accountants out there looking at for loopholes in the guidance we put out last week.
I get all of that, but don't you think this plays as the U.S. government going after two companies specifically with this administrative action?
We don't make policy based on individual companies.
Sir, come on.
You look at the impact of this company, it sends a powerful signal in the future of what is permitted and what is not permitted. And the goal has been all along to stop the pipeline. We don't do it retrospectively. So if you closed a deal, if you completed a deal, I don't know what other deals are caught up in this. But, you know, I hope that we've stopped the pipeline for a while.
This piece did not come out of the Treasury Department speech writing shop. You wrote it yourself. And as we sit here under a bust, actually, of Alexander Hamilton, and with Hamilton all in the news, I wonder if this is Jack Lew's legacy piece right here.
You know, I have thought that you know, after 3 years of fighting a kind of quiet fight on the IMF quota reforms, dozens if not hundreds of conversations with congressional leaders, that there was a real burden to make a public case so that maybe this will be a little bit easier the next time. It has to be that there is a broader understanding of what we do to create the space for the U.S. to have the influence that we need for our economic and our national security. And I thought this was an appropriate moment to do it.
A little pride of ownership there. I see the smile on your face.
I'm proud to have been part of it. It's not all my work.
Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Good to be with you, Kai.
A reminder as I set up this next piece that what's important in economic stories quite often isn't always the news of the day, but the way the trends are playing out long term. Case in point, oil, crude touched 4-month highs today, $40 and change for a barrel of it at the close in New York. But over the past, year and a half or so, right, oil is down, way down, which has meant nothing good for most people and companies involved in that industry. But one industry's bust is another's boom. Auction houses that are helping drillers and oil services companies sell off their gear are busier than ever. From Colorado Public Radio, Grace Hood takes us to a recent auction near Denver.
Auction day doesn't come around that often at Ritchie Brothers. Vice President Rob Giroux says one event takes months to put together. Every piece of equipment has to be cataloged and brought to this location. And these days, during an oil bust, there's thousands to be sold.
There's no doubt that the oil and gas downturn has positively affected our business.
Giroux watches the bidding from the back of Ritchie Brothers' massive auction theater. For each item, the whole bidding process happens in minutes. When a bid is launched, its number pops up onto a large computer screen. This one is a yellow machine on four wheels with a big arm in the front.
You'll see telescopic forklifts, for example, what we're selling right now. A lot of these have come from the oil and gas market, but it's not limited to that market.
And then the bidding just takes off. Buyers today will pay anything from a few thousand to more than $100,000 to buy equipment. This auction house makes a commission off of sales. Giroux says the uptick started in 2015. In this Denver location, there are 4,000 items for sale, a new record. The previous record was 2,500.
We're still seeing a significant amount of oil and gas-related equipment. You just need to look out in our yard here.
Take a walk outside, and all you see is equipment. It's a sea of orange, yellow, and blue industrial-sized trucks, steamrollers, and cranes. To be fair, not everything here is from the oil and gas industry. There's shipping containers and street sweepers.
I'm looking for something cheap.
Angel Salazar is studying a row of cylindrical tank trailers. He came from New Mexico to check out the auction. He's looking for equipment to add to his drilling business, which has struggled over the last year. He even had to lay off workers, so he needs a bargain.
For example, this tank here, when they built it, it cost $75,000 each. I can probably buy them for $10,000 right now. And that's the kind of deals I'm looking for.
Nearby, Rich Millard from North Dakota investigates portable tanks used during the fracking process. He says he's never seen an auction as large as this one.
This is tragic for the oil industry.
But Millard does think the oil business will recover. That's why he's here. He recently launched a company that disposes oil field waste in an environmentally friendly way.
We're building the business and we're preparing for the next upswing in the oil industry.
Angel Salazar also has hope that the next upswing is around the corner. But with more than four decades in the oil business, he says now is a pivotal moment. If you buy stuff, will you actually be able to put it to work and recoup your expenses? That's a catch-22 many businesses are in right now.
I can see a little light at the end of the tunnel. People are calling back and they want to do things, they want to do this. So hopefully we'll get back going here in another 2 or 3 months.
But there's going to be more pain before it's all over. Continued low oil prices are expected to prompt more bankruptcies across the industry. It all adds up to more reasons why the auction business won't be slowing down anytime soon. I'm Grace Hood for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, fittingly perhaps the final thing that I asked Secretary Liu when we spoke today, here you go.
Last thing, then I'll let you go. I need some love on the $10 bill. Hamilton's staying, right?
You know, we're going to have a really exciting announcement really soon. People have to hear the whole of what I've said, so I'm going to just take a second and repeat what I've said. But there are people around the country at school lunch tables, at senior centers, at workplaces, talking about what women should we recognize and how have women contributed to democracy in America. As a student of history, that is just exciting and thrilling that people are actually focused on this. We're doing something bigger than just one face on one bill. And we're going to be looking at the whole series of bills, the $5 bill, the $10 bill, the $20 bill. And we're looking at how to use the front and the back of the bill to tell stories. Right. But stay tuned. We're going to have an interesting announcement very soon.
Soon?
Yeah, very soon.
All right.
I tried, y'all. He just wouldn't give it up. You can find the whole interview with the Treasury Secretary. We talked for about half an hour or so. You've heard 10 of it if you're listening to the whole show today. The audio and a transcript are at marketplace.org. Hey, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow off 20 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ down 17 points, about a 3%. The S&P 500 slipped 5 points, a 0.25% there. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.